Hello everybody and welcome to the Artist First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You are tuning into the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show. This show airs at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Monday. For more information about this show and to listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/MaxineThompson.htm. And now here is your host of the Maxine Thompson Show, Dr. Maxine Thompson.
Good evening. Thank you for tuning in to the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show. As you know, I'm the author of The Ebony Tree, award-winning Hostage of Lies, short story collection A Place Called Home, and newly released novel L.A. Blues. I also have e-books online on Amazon.com and on Barnes & Noble's The Hush Hush Secrets of Writing Fiction That Sells, The Hush Hush Secrets of Making Money as a Writer, All in the Family, A Place Called Home, and Never Knew Love Like This Before. You can email any questions to dj@artistfirst.com. Tonight's guest is T. Styles. She is an entrepreneur, Essence bestselling author, and owner of the Cartel Publications. Good evening, T. How are you doing tonight?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for coming on the show. We met about 5 years ago, didn't we, through online?
We sure did. We had as an experience.
Yes, but anyhow, it's all good. It all worked out.
It was great. One of the best pieces of advice I received in my career, for sure.
Okay, yes. Well, can you share some of it? It had to do with the editing. You know, we don't have to go into how we met through what company, but could you tell them how we met as me editing one of your books?
Right. You were actually on a project. It was originally was going to be a mini-series with one particular topic, and what you were working with me with was trying to make sure that I developed my characters, making sure I had a strong storyline, and you suggested the hero's journey. Because I think what I was doing was I may have had an idea, but because I'm a writer, I was going into like 10 or 15 different directions at one time. So you were able to help me channel that by, you know, reading the hero's journey, and I use it actually to this day.
Yes, the hero's journey is excellent for any writer to read, and all you have to do is Google it, and all the major blockbusters and movies and all the major books use some variation of it. Well, tell us about your latest novel.
Well, my latest novel, the one that I released recently, is called A Raunchy Part 2, and basically it comes from the first part, of course, Raunchy, about a mother who grew up in an environment where her father was a drug dealer and her mother was jealous of a lot of things. There were a lot of secrets that weren't really expressed to her when she was growing up, her being the main character, Harmony, as a child. But anyway, she was taken out of her home and thrust into an environment that was full of molestation, alcoholism. It was a lot going on. And she grew up and ended up having children. So the premise of the story is basically taking the reader through a journey of a young girl who ends up, you know, like I said, having kids and what her kids go through. So first book is about the mother as a child and her life as a teenager and adult. And then the second part is about her, one of her first children. And then the second part is about the third children. The third part actually is about the third child, or the second child. So it's the mother and the two kids. So that's how I broke it up, giving you their life from their point of view.
Okay, well, I have a young writer that I work with, and he's always telling me, in fact, he brought you back into my awareness because he said, oh, her book, Raunchy, is just jumping off the shelves.
it's graphic, but it's definitely a method to my madness. When I write books, now, actually, in my career, maybe not in the past, but now, I want to make sure I use all my senses. I want to make sure you see, feel, smell. So I take a reader through a lot. I've witnessed people, like, going off when they read my book. Like, can't believe some of the things that they actually read in it, but it actually holds them. It's graphic, but it's also a message to it, and I think a lot of readers are able to grasp that. So I'm grateful. Definitely love that that particular book or that series is a part of my bibliography.
And I also like your book, Black and Ugly. It's almost become a famous line from Color Purple where they say, I may be black.
Right.
I'm glad that you dealt with that because that's something that was hidden within the black community, and I understand other races have an issue with light skin. They have, this is the month for Latino month, and I watched the Latino list, and that was what they said. Like, black people would say, does he have good hair? Is his hair good?
Right.
Latino would say, is he dark? You know, want to know if the child have fair skin or dark. And you dealt with that in your book, Black and Ugly, and that was one of your first books I read, and I really enjoyed it. What inspired you to write that book, T?
I actually got inspired to write Black and Ugly. Well, I was inspired to write Black and Ugly for two reasons. The first reason was I was unemployed. I didn't have a job, and the company that published that book, I went on their website and found, I guess, looked at all of their titles, and I wanted to deliver something to them that they didn't have already. So I actually wrote Black and Ugly, and the other book I wrote with them called A Hustler Son in 2 weeks, trying to get a deal. And so my first motivation was, you know, trying to get a deal, trying to, you know, be able to feed my family. I was unemployed. The second motivation is I grew up in a family where color was definitely an issue. My sister was light-skinned, and although I'm not as dark as, you know, some of the other women who, I guess, go through these issues, I still heard it a lot. Like, you know, she's cute to be dark-skinned. Or even though she's not as light as your sister, you know, you're still pretty. I mean, it's prevalent, and it bothered me a lot. For a while, it had me thinking I was unattractive, being uncomfortable with my lips. I remember at one point, well, actually a lot of points, when my mother used to tell me to suck my lip in because my lip is too big. And for the longest time, it impacted my smile. And it wasn't until I got ran into my business partner, Sharice Washington. She said, why do you always, like tighten your lip up and hide your teeth when you smile? And I never realized I was doing that, but it impacted me throughout my entire life, and I just stopped doing that 3 or 4 years. So that was another thing with Black and Ugly. She's dark-skinned, but she's also persecuted because of it. You know, people are playing on the fact that she doesn't have any self-confidence, and it's just, you know, she's just going through the growing pains of appreciating who she is.
Yes, and I think that was the same journey that Celie had to go through to come to a point of empowerment.
Right. And I think oftentimes, all the times, whenever a person persecutes another person for their complexion, weight, size, whatever, basically they're showing their insecurities. And that's really all it is. Because my complexion, how I look, how, you know, what I eat is not impacting you. So if you're trying to show the differences between us, you're basically doing it because you're insecure for whatever reason. And that's what I found, like, you know, through writing, that a lot of people who, you know, talk about people all the time, gossiping and this, that, and the third, a lot of times they're really insecure. And that goes, I think it rings true for also, you know, the color divide that we're experiencing right now.
Right. And it goes back to the Willie Lynch syndrome.
Right, yep.
Where they were told, where you can pit the slaves and it will last 300 to 400 years. Pit light skin against dark skin.
Young against old, yep. I'm actually writing about a little of that, not getting too much, because I like to give my readers a little, drop a few jewels, but not too much. But I'm doing that in my current book I'm writing right now called Redbone. I talk about that briefly, the Willie Lynch syndrome.
Great. Well, I went to your website, and I see you're doing a lot of things. You have a bookstore. You have a film division, Carfield Urban Cinema.
Yep.
So let's talk about, well, how did you go from just being an author to building your publishing company? Let's start there.
Well, I went from being an author to starting my publishing house because I was with a publisher who really didn't appreciate my talent and pretty much told me if I believe in myself so much, put my own money where my mouth was. So that's exactly what I did. So actually that's what sparked me really doing it on my own. And I had actually been a little bit into self-publishing before I got with Triple Crown Publications or Productions or whatever you want to call them, because there's a lot of controversy around that right now. But I had actually self-published a book on my own before, and I had some experience, but not enough. So once I got with Triple Crown, I was able to see a little bit more about what I needed to do. So when it was time, it was time. Her brother, Benzo, gave us some contacts. We got out there, had a few other people who were willing to help us, and we haven't looked back. And that's how the company, Cartel Publications, started.
Okay.
And yeah, right now, we're about 20. Yes, I have a business partner. Her name is Sharice Washington.
Okay.
She's been with me from my very first book, Rainbow Heart.
How many books did you say you have? I'm sorry.
Right now, we have about 23. About 23. So hopefully by the end of the year it'll be 24.
Great.
So it's been doing very good. We have ebooks, paperbacks. We're adapting our books into movies right now, and we're going to be doing audio books next year.
Great. Well, how did you start your bookstore? Which one came next, the bookstore or the film?
The bookstore came next. I actually think, sometimes I get my dates mixed up, but I don't think we were in business long before, maybe like 6 or 7 months before the bookstore opened. That was definitely a really good investment. About 8 months. That was a good investment because we had a place to, you know, house the books. We were able to see what was hot, what wasn't. We're able to talk to our readers, get feedback from them. So it was just a really good investment all the way around to open the bookstore. And we've been open for like 3 years? 3 years. We've been doing pretty good.
And you haven't had any problem with the e-books cutting into your print book sales? How many of the bookstores here have closed? Or they're not doing as well as they used to do. When I go to them, I notice they don't have as much inventory as they used to have, and when they have book signings, it's not that many people in the store. Do you have that problem?
No, I think one of the reasons why we don't have that problem is, number one, we're publishers. So even though we own the bookstore, we still have publishing business. You know, we sell to bookstores also. But I find that the customers over in our area, they want physical copies. I've had people who have purchased our ebooks and will come back and do a hard copy just to have it. So we haven't really experienced that at all. And also we knew which market we were going into. The market that we're in, the readers are generally into street fiction or urban fiction. So we knew what market we were going into, and that helped us also. We didn't just jump out there and get a space and, you know, have to really work really hard to build it. So, and I don't even think, right now, even though we've been in business for 3 years, I don't think we've reached the full potential yet because we're still new. Right. We get people all the time that come by and say, I didn't even know you were over here.
What is your website and what is your address for the bookstore?
The website for the bookstore is cartelcafeandbooks.com, and the address is 5011 B Indian Head Highway in Oxon Hill, Maryland, and that's Oxon Hill, Maryland, and it's 20745.
Okay. And then when did you decide to start making some of your books into films?
We decided to do that last year. And the funny part about it is we picked the book that required the most cast members, the most scenes. I have no idea what possessed us to do that book first as a movie. But we were blessed with an outstanding new cast. 90% of our cast members, they've never acted before, but you would not be able to tell once you see the movie. And we just wanted to do it. We've always wanted to do it, and it was a lot of stuff going on. I said, you know what, let's just do it now. Let's not wait any longer. And we just jumped out there. We put ourselves in a position where we couldn't turn around. We had to do the movie. You know, people were looking for it. The cast members were all involved, and we just stayed with it. We had a lot of issues. Whenever you get a lot of people together, you have issues. But it wasn't as bad, I'm hearing, as some movie sets. but we did have some prima donnas every now and again. You know, we had to check them and get back in order. But for the most part, we had a really, really good cast. And we just closed up this past weekend. We got our final scene.
Oh. So did you shoot on, you know, were some of your settings taken from that area that you live in Maryland? Or?
Yep, some were taken from D.C. We shot Baltimore, everywhere. Now, the movie is based out of, supposed to be set in the D.C. area in a fictitious project called Emerald City, which is supposed to be in D.C., but we shot all over the place. D.C., Maryland, I don't think we did Virginia. But, yeah, we had a lot of shots. And it was fun. You know, we had, like I said, we had a energetic cast. We had a hungry cast. We didn't really get a lot of authors who were established. We had a few, actors who are established. We had a few of them, but for the most part, it was brand new. We have an excellent director. Her name is Seven. And she was actually working with these new actors and pretty much giving them acting lessons on point. And they were able to receive it really well, and because of that, it made it more natural. Like, you would not be able to tell when this movie drops that these people have never acted before.
Wow, that's wonderful. Let me see. Now, when is the movie coming
out? And they looked the part also. Like, they really looked like the characters in the book. We went to Harlem Book Fair this past year, July. And we had a few of the actors with us, and people were just saying how much they looked just like them. So the movie was originally slated for October, but with us, I didn't want to just put a movie out just to put a movie out. We wanted to make sure that we had every scene that we needed in order to make sure, you know, the production was right. What we're doing, though, next year, we're going to take it to film festivals and all of that. So we wanted to make sure it was right. So even though originally we said October, if we didn't have what we needed because of the rain or whatever, we waited, you know, we told cast members we can't do it right now, and we're just making sure everything falls right. We're not just trying to submit a rush project because there are fans waiting on this movie.
And is this one from Pitbulls in a Skirt?
Yep, it's Pitbulls in a Skirt.
Oh, okay, that's an interesting title.
And if people are interested, they can actually go on the website, cartelurbancinema.com. And they can see the cast members. All of them are there. What we did was, right before we did filming, we took everybody out for drinks, and we mingled with each other. The objective there was, like, to get everybody used to, you know, talking to each other, hanging around each other, so that they would have camaraderie, and it'll show across, and it'll come across on the screen. So if they wanted to see them, they're all on there on the website, the main characters, anyway.
Yeah, I went through it yesterday. It was interesting. I said, this shows how it's so much easier to shoot a film now, too. What kind of camera did you use?
Oh, we had HD cameras, digital cameras.
Okay.
Yep, we didn't do any film. Everything is digital. Right. We didn't want to get involved in any of that, you know, big films, expensive films and all of that. We had HD cameras, and we had two of them. So, which I know a lot of people are doing movies and they have the one, but we had two cameras, and sometimes we even had three if somebody else, you know, one of our camera girls, sometimes if she needed to come through with her, she would come through with her. So for the most part, we definitely had two cameras on set at all times.
And who wrote the screenplay version of the book?
Okay, I wrote the screenplay, Seven, and even my business partner, Sharice Washington, she got in there and did it too. A lot of times we had to rewrite. Like, there was a scene, there was a part in the movie where I didn't feel the women characters were coming across strong enough. So the next day, I rewrote that script, gave it to them, and they were not only excited about it, but they delivered. It really gave the movie that extra push that it needed because I just didn't like that one particular portion. I felt like it needed more. So even though we all wrote the script, there were times we had to do it on set. And there were times where the actors would ad-lib, and then you didn't even want to say anything because it was so good. You know, you can't let them go too far, but they were sometimes they may have added their own personality, and it was came across so well, we just kept it.
Oh, good.
One of the things that the director told them is that if you forget the lines, don't stop. Just keep going. So instead of, like, saying cut and starting all over again, just keep going until she says cut, You just ad-lib, do what you got to do so we can get past the scene, and if we don't like it, we'll just run it again.
Oh, okay. Yes, I noticed they do a lot of unscripted, like Larry David show.
Right.
Unscripted now, and you would never know it. It's as though they just fit in, so it's probably even better when they have this spontaneous moment.
Right, just to give them the basic, like, you know, this is the premise and run with it. Reno 911 did that too a lot. That's one of my favorite shows to this day. They'll give them the basic premise and they'll just let them just do what they do. What do they call it? Not ad-libbing, improv.
Yeah. Well, good. And I mean, just to start, how many actors? It looked like it's about 20 people.
Oh, my God. How many actors do you think? How many actors do we have? It may be 30 or more.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm telling you, I have no idea why we picked this book. It has to be the one. You know, we'll be able to see, like, whenever we came back and we looked at the dailies, you know, it just jumped across the screen. So we know it was the right one, but it was so much work, especially for, you know, the vice president of my company, Cherise, and the director, because sometimes I was able to step back. I had good people in place to make sure things went good. Them guys had to be on the set every day. Whenever we was on set, they had to be out there. I'm talking about cold. It was sometimes the weather was so cold that it was ridiculous, and those actors had to stay out there in that cold and deliver those scenes, and they did it every time.
Oh.
It was a lot. It was like brutal, because the movie takes place during the winter months, and that's exactly what it was.
Oh,
it didn't start out like that. It started in June. It was June or July. It was a warmer month, September or October, so it wasn't as cold. But then it got really cold, and they used to have to be out there, rain, sleet, or snow. We shoveling snow and everything. It was crazy.
Okay, so there was snow in the is snow in the background of the
Yeah, sometimes there was snow.
Okay.
The good thing about it was the movie was set in the winter months, so you know, if it was a snow problem, if we've already filmed a particular scene and it was snow, we couldn't shoot, because if it wasn't snow before, we can't shoot with snow now. But if it wasn't, or if it was, if the snow wasn't there, we haven't filmed any part of it before, we just work with it. So a lot of times there was snow, but, you know, not all the time, but a lot of times. Sometimes you don't want to really work with snow because it'll mess with the cameras and the audio equipment. But if it's already on the ground and it's not coming down, then we just did what we had to do.
Huh. I'm telling you, people know how to make a way out of no way.
Right. And then, too, with the movie, it's so important because you can't keep calling people back. People are calling off of work. They got to get babysitters. So it's hard, you know, to waste their time. When you have them on set, you got to take advantage of them. So, like I said, a lot of times we really work through it. But they were 30 people, 30 lifestyles, and we all had to work together.
Yes. And so Seven was the director. I remember when she was writing a book, and then I've heard that she had...
Oh, no, not her. Not her.
This is another lady named Seven. Okay.
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about. I'm glad you said that. Her name is actually Cecilia, C.C. Washington.
Oh.
It's actually my vice president's sister.
Oh, okay. So this is a different Seven. Okay.
Yes. Yep. Seven of Seven View Productions.
I mean, it's like all this talent coming together and making a way. And this is, when you look at the early Spike Lee movies, he used the same people over and over.
Right.
And some even have blown up, as you know, Denzel and Isaiah Washington and different ones. I was just looking at Brooklyn. And I didn't realize that Martin and a lot of the actors.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Especially when you use people who are dedicated. Like, there are a lot of people we worked with on a movie that I know I want to work with again, a few of them. And then there are some people who I don't ever want to see again. And they know, I'm sure they know who they are. So, but yeah, there, for the most part, I have a lot of people who I feel comfortable calling back and saying, you know, would you like to be in our next film?
That's great. You know, and I think what's good now about the film industry is you can put things on YouTube and, as you say, going to the film festivals. trying to do that before you have a showing in a in a movie theater or anything?
No, we're gonna do the premiere first. I'm here, so family members and friends and everybody can see it, and then we're gonna do the film festivals.
Okay.
And we're trying to see if we can get major distribution first. If not, we already know we can distribute this movie. We have a fan base, but we're looking for the major distributors. So that's what we want to submit it to these film festivals and see how it do. I know it's going to do great once they see these actresses. They're really talented. They're dedicated, and you believe them when you see them on the screen.
Well, give a brief synopsis about Pit Bulls in a Skirt.
Okay. Pit Bulls in a Skirt is about... four women who were made to run a project in the fictitious part of D.C. called Emerald City. Their boyfriends pretty much used to run the project. When I say run the project, I mean they were drug dealers. And they ended up expanding, so they couldn't really be in Emerald City and run it like they used to. So they put their girlfriends in charge of the operation. What happened was one of the guys ended up bringing another girl into the mix. And even though he dealt with one of the pit bulls, and a lot of drama ended up, coming about. So the girl said, you know what? We're not going to let you take this project back and rerun this. There's nothing y'all can do about it. So it was drama between those two. But what I really like about Pit Bulls in a Skirt is sometimes you see movies where black girl women, they fussing and they going back and forth with each other. These girls are friends, and they put each other first over their men, and that's uncommon. So they're really good friends. They love each other, and they support each other, even if it means, turning their backs on their men. And you see they deserve it. They're cheating on their women. They don't have a respect for them. So they say, you know what? We're going to take this project. I don't care what you say. We're running this, and there's nothing you can do about it. So those two couples or those two entities, they're going back and forth with each other, and that's pretty much what it's about.
It's gonna be different.
It's gonna be good because these girls aren't like, they look like models but not, they high heels, they're running the project with high heels. They're not like whores. I'm talking about jeans, boots. They're what we call fly girls that are running this project, but you believe them when they're holding the fake guns and when they're arguing with their men. You believe them as drug dealers.
Okay, well, this sounds like New Jack City with a female twist.
a crazy twist.
Uh-huh.
And really good emotional scenes. We have a young lady named Shonda Mays who is, one of the main characters. There were scenes where she had to break down and cry and be vulnerable, and she nailed it. It's so many different, it's funny scenes, emotional scenes. You're gonna be rooting for them. We have scenes where people are getting chased. It's one part when I was watching it and I got scared. I'm watching it on the screen. I wasn't there on the day they filmed that particular scene, and I got scared for this girl as if I wasn't there. So that's how good these actors are. They really did a good job, but I'm so proud of them.
Wonderful. Let me check and see if we have any emails. Do we have any emails?
Yeah, there's actually one email, and it reads, do you plan to make any other books into movies? If so, which book or books do you plan to do so?
We want to make the Shitless book into a movie. We've gotten calls from outside sources who are interested, some famous entertainers. And I think what we want to do is we want to see how well we produce this movie, because if we do as well as we believe we are, we're going to go ahead and do it ourselves. So that should be the next one, the Shitless book.
Okay, that's it for now. But if anybody would like to ask a question to the guests, just please email dj@artistfirst.com, and I'll be sure to read them to her.
So it's no number to call in. This is the email, right?
All right.
DJ. Yep. DJ@artistfirst.com. Letter DJ@artistfirst.com.
Okay. DJ@artistfirst.com. Okay.
And then the other thing too, this show will be archived at the end of the week and it'll be up, you know, from now on, and you can put it on your website or you can put it through Facebook once it's archived. So it's not just today, you know.
Oh, okay.
There's today, but it's ongoing. They have all the shows archived at
first,
and I have them archived. There's a link on my website at MaxineThompson.com where I have the archive, too.
Okay.
Yes, but, you know, what I like is when I see writers take their gift and their craft and turn it into a business, and instead of whining and begging someone else to give them a
break,
they go create a break. What was your background like? What field were you in before you got into, you know, the business of publishing?
I was doing so many things. I was actually working for Verizon as a customer service rep, but while I was working for Verizon, I got certified in massage therapy, and what I did with my certified massage therapist license was opened up a business where we would go into other businesses and talk about wellness, health. We provided seated massage. I worked for companies like CareFirst, Blue Cross, Blue Shield hired us, the U.S. Supreme Court, and that was really getting so successful that it kind of scared me because I still had a full-time job. So I was doing that. I also did a little bit of modeling, you know, when I was a little bit smaller. Did that for a while. Hated that. Hated the idea of somebody looking at me or giving me money based on how I look, realizing that change. So I didn't like that at all. I may have done that maybe 2 months. So I did a lot of stuff. Worked for the post office at one point. I've been all over the place. Got in trouble a lot. As a teenager, a youth, I did a lot. My background is so vast. Sometimes I forget all the things that I did before I actually got into publishing.
Uh-huh, that's good. It takes a wide, I think, just a vast wealth of experience to be able to draw on things to be a writer, and then to be an entrepreneur. You just have to kind of be a visionary and a dreamer and a person.
Right.
Sees the future and see possibility where there's nothing.
Right.
How do you feel about where urban fiction is headed now?
I'm actually really proud of where urban fiction is headed now. I know some people think that it's not really going anywhere, but when you see authors like Ashley Jaquavis, Kwan, and these guys really taking the time to develop strong characters, develop strong storylines, you know, and to grow in their field, I really think that it's going in a good direction. You're going to have people who jump on the bandwagon and, you know, get into it for a minute, but those guys are going to fall by the wayside. You know, for you to be able to really be in this genre or in this career, you have to really want this. I write sometimes 16, 17 hours a day. I may start at 7 in the morning and may not finish writing until like 3 the following morning. You know, I'm just writing. But I'm writing so long and don't even realize I'm writing that long. But this is what I really love to do. So I am really proud of the direction it's going. And I know, you know, some people, like I said, some people may not be. But just with anything, it needs work. But I think we're better now than where we started a few years ago. That's my personal opinion anyway.
And I'll give my opinion. I'm from the blaxploitation era
where
we had no one. We had no one. So even though, and I go back and watch Foxy Brown, the movies now, and I laugh because we were never even given parts in movies, and that's why everybody likes the movie Sweetback.
I saw that.
Right, we were always given the part where we were the slave getting beat.
Right.
So for the first time, we were kicking you know what and taking names. And so we would just be roaring. And I'm an elder now. And
right.
I still enjoy street fiction because I'm seeing more young people read. And say from there, they'll read. They can go on and read the classics and read Toni Morrison and all the greats from there, but at least they're reading because they're seeing something that reflects a reality that's relevant to them. If we didn't have hoods and ghettos and projects, then they wouldn't want to read those books. So the books are reflecting what's really real. And for people to say, oh, they shouldn't read those books, then they're denying their own reality. This is, they're too American.
That's exactly.
bigger gap. And that's why I've done what my contribution has been, my editing skills. You know, I was an English major.
Right.
I grew up in the inner city of Detroit, so I had the same life experience, same young, in trouble type of background as a young person. I was one of those persons who wasn't derailed by my youth and was able to go on and finish college by 22 and become a social worker, whole career, 23. So I'm writing from both sides of the fence. I've been in so-called, quote, middle America now. And now I'm just free. I'm a free woman. I work for myself. I work from home. And I'm a senior, too. So when I see complaints, she's not representing this and that. I'm retired. I don't have to do nothing if I choose. But
exactly.
To do this. And that's the whole thing. I think the message that I get out of street fiction, and I edit Christian, women's fiction, mystery. So I'm not, you know, this is just one of the genres I picked up over the last 6 years. But what I learned from it is a choice, that the message is you do have a choice. And most of the books are showing consequences for bad choices that you make. And, you know, even though you might feel like, well, I can't help but be a crip, because that's one of the issues I have in my book, L.A. Blues. Well, I can't help but, you know, be a drug dealer because this is the area I'm in. And, but we always have a choice, and that's the underlying message. Just the fact that publishers, Main Street, the gatekeepers were keeping the books out, and people have self-published them and built a lucrative market. That's
right.
A choice there.
Right. I definitely agree. And with anything, you have people who, you know, maybe are just doing it just because. It doesn't speak to the entire market. You know, it's not everybody. Like I said, those guys are going to fall off. The most of us who are doing it, and we've been doing it for a while, we're doing it because we have a passion. You know, we're doing it because this is what we love. And like you said, we have a voice. We have a story to tell. I know Raunchy is a graphic book, but that book is currently being read by or being reviewed in Bowie University by a professor and his students. So even they receive the message. So it depends on, you know, the market, the audience, what they're going to say. But I definitely don't pay them any mind. I learned a long time ago, when you hear or you pay too much attention to what critics say, you know, it'll stunt your growth. And at the end of the day, they're not paying your bills. You're never going to see these people again. So why let them stop you from doing something that you really want to do?
All right. And who's to say that it's art when it's literary wear? You know, I've read the only books we had available when I was coming up to, I was 17 when I formed a walkout. We didn't have any black books in school, and I organized the walkout. So I've always been a literary activist, even though I didn't know it. And one of the things, the English teacher brought in a black section, and she had James Baldwin in different sections in her. And then we even got a black history class. And we never had any of that. And can you imagine a world where there were no black books? But that's what many of us grew up. And today, there's still a lot of schools don't have any black books in their library or black books in their whole curriculum. And I say, how can you have libraries that don't represent people who built this country?
I remember a situation that really hurt me to the core. So even right now, sometimes I don't even like to talk about it, but it's in the same, but it maybe not. But basically, I went to this school. I think it was called Daylight Twilight or something. And what they were doing was they were having different professionals come up and talk about their career. I forget who else they had, but it was me as a writer. It was a school where they have people, kids who didn't really make it in high school, and they'll go to this school to try to get their diploma. And I was in this class, and this is when Black and Ugly was out. And my class was so full, it was crazy. Like, everybody was in the class. But when I left, they were inspired to write books. And I was going to take my money out of my bank account and host a contest. I think it was the secretary or somebody like that, read the title, saw the title, Black and Ugly, and prevented me from doing anything to help these students write books just because she was offended by the title, Black and Ugly. Hadn't read the book or anything. Had she read the book and really understood what the book was representing, maybe, you know, she would have been different. Who knows? But based on that, you know, she pretty much ran this whole campaign and had my book thrown out of the school and told the students they weren't able to participate in the contest. And that was a black woman that did that.
Yes, we have a lot of issues, and they go back to the Willie Lynch syndrome, where the very one of us who want to talk against Ebonics, against urban lit or street fiction or ghetto lit, whichever one you want to call it, and talk down their nose, the very ones who are doing that, a lot of them grew up in poor environments themselves, and they want to forget from whence they came. But if you don't know your past, you can never change it, you know, and that's where the problem. So many of our young people don't even know even about the civil rights movement because it's been such a whiting out in the school districts and in the history books. Don't know all the contributions until Black History Month that black people made. And now, you know, and then for a long time, whenever we wrote, we were only supposed to write things that represented the race, and that's why Zora Neale Hurston died broke, because she told the truth, and she was one who always talked about she called them the literati, she used the N-word back then, were trying to have their nose in the air, but she wrote about, because she came from an Afrocentric background where they had a black mayor in Florida, father was a mayor, I mean, they just had everything. Well, her father was a minister, but they had where all the people in power, they saw, I guess even their law officers were black, sort of like Rosewood before it got burned down. They had their own black or the Black Wall Street. So she had this embracing of blackness, and she loved it, and they hated her. And that's what I see now is a self-hatred that's inverse, where a person wouldn't want, and you know, to get mad about a book saying black and ugly, and she might have called somebody that. It wasn't a reality. How can we heal all these psychoses? We have a lot of psychoses in the black community, starting with fatherlessness, starting with self-hatred. These are the things that nobody else can fix but us, and our books are a way of healing. I call it bibliotherapy. So,
and she stole the, you know, the students their dreams. What I saw when I was in that class and I was speaking to those children, I was like, I saw in their eyes, wow, she's, you know, she has a career from this. She's doing this. I have a story to tell too. Maybe I can be a writer. She just stole that by making it sound like what I was writing about was shameful. And it was terrible. I received so many letters from those students. And they were heartbroken. And she just was on this mission to, I mean, it worked. But it was just so sad because they were so excited. I mean, you had students writing who didn't even want to, you know, do essays. They wanted to write books. You know, they maybe didn't even do their classwork. They wanted to write books. They wanted to tell their story, and she just stole it from them. That moment to this day just burns me up.
Yeah, that's the worst thing. I know for myself, I was, I heard Quan say this about himself. He had a photographic memory when I met him for the first time at the National Black Conference, and I do believe that a lot of African Americans have lost so much talent because I was told there were different things I created when I was in the first and second grade, and I was told that the white student had to do it, and they would even give them the work or give them the credit for the work. And I've seen them do it even with my younger son when he went to a predominantly white school. So I ended up putting him in private school that was black and from seventh grade on. But I watched that where so many, if you're kind of gifted, and my youngest son was considered gifted, his IQ was 155, and it was as though they went on a mission to destroy his creativity. I never knew what my IQ was, but I do know that I was put on the wrong path because nobody wanted to give credit to a bright black child, as they call it, to be young, gifted, and black. And I'm not even saying you have to be gifted to write a book. You can just have all types of gifts that are being stolen. And I hate to think all the gifts that have been lost to all this murder and black-on-black crime. And I think this is something that our writing can help address.
And that was another thing, too. Like, they heard my background. You know, I don't have a college degree. I got a GED, and that's why I was a good, to me, I felt like I was a good spokesperson. I was a good example of what you can do if you just stay the course. I don't have, like I said, I don't have these things, and I have a career, a really good career in writing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get past the ninth grade. You know, I got my GED in the ninth grade. And I did have some college courses, but like I said, I stopped school in ninth grade. So that was giving them hope, you know. And I didn't start writing a book until 2005. Never thought about being a writer prior to that time. So, and I just ended up lucking up in it, you know, getting into the industry, and it ended up being the right thing for me.
Yeah.
So you just really never know.
Yeah, finding your path and finding your passion and your purpose. That's what they call
right.
Living a purpose-filled life. That was your purpose. All the other things, you had to go through those to bring you to this point. I say for all the bad and good I've been through in life, the good has always outweighed the bad, and it brought me to this moment in time, because I feel that for me having to be in a part of time where we didn't even have black kids in the books, and we played, I always tell people I do what I do because this is a game I never want to see children have to play. We had a game called Playing White, because to be white puts you in power. That's all we saw on TV.
Right.
And one friend burned her eyebrows off because she had a towel on her head while she was baking toast, and that's when you put it in the oven. And because she had her towel as her hair, instead of being happy with your black hair. There's no hair.
Mm-hmm.
Black hair. Now people are paying for black lips. That's why you said that. I wanted to interject that about people are paying to get lips like yours, paying to get these full hips.
Right.
So, you know, it's been a whole reversal, but it's still a long time to get that sense of unworthiness out of our young people. And a lot of our young kids, I see it in their face that nobody's telling them they're beautiful. And
all right.
And so books could have been a way of making these kids feel good about themselves.
And books and definitely are a way. Like, there are a lot of issues that I'm very passionate about that I sneak into my books, like suicide. You know, in the black community, people, you know, we don't believe in suicide. It's something wrong with you. Or you're depressed or whatever, just get over it, you know, get back to work. That's a real issue. I attempted suicide. You know, I would not have been here had, you know, I didn't have a friend at the time who sensed something in my voice that wasn't right. I'm very passionate about that. That's another issue that I talk about in my books. And I get emails and stuff all the time where, you know, people saying, oh, my God, I experienced that too. That's real.
Okay.
So we need these books, and we need authors like myself, you know, and a lot of these other authors to address some of these issues, even though I don't believe it's our main responsibility. But I believe myself that if I can put that in my book some way and give a message and save a life or, you know, help somebody, then I feel better about that. But there are a lot of issues that we need to talk about.
Yeah, I call it healing, because we've been the biggest secret keepers. We've been... My book, Hostage of Lies, is about how we have so many secrets and lies, and until we face the truth, we cannot heal. And that's, to me, the underlying of all books, is some type of healing.
Right.
Somebody should read it and say, you know, these people are sick, but they sure look like my family. They look
sick. Mm-hmm.
And the best writers are the ones that people talk about. Oh, they gonna write about that?
Yes.
That's awful. They picked it at Alice Walker's movie when Color Purple came out, and now it's a classic.
Yep.
You don't want to write what everybody agree with. That you want to shake people up. We need to shake up people's thinking.
That's exactly what I did with the book Ronji. That's probably one of the most controversial books I get all the time. I can't believe she wrote this stuff in this book. But I wanted to scratch up emotions. I wanted you to say you. Either I hate this girl for writing this book, or I love it. I wanted some type of emotion when you read that book. I didn't want, you know, I didn't tiptoe around any subject. I went in on everything that I need to go into to get you to think about certain things. Like, people are having conversations about, you know, being a mother. It's not just about having sex and you know, having a child. There's a process. If you don't feel right within yourself, maybe you should not have a child. And if you do, maybe you should get help. Like, I talk about all that in this book. And you see what it takes. You see the effects it has on her child. and how she comes up. So now I had a bad mother. How am I going to interact with people and things like that? Like, I honestly believe if you grow up and you don't have a person that'll hug you and touch you, how can you show emotion to another human being? It's hard. You know, you definitely need that. So that's why, again, these books are so important. A lot of times people can't see certain traits in themselves, but when they read a book, they be like, wow, that sounds like me a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's so important.
Abuse and women in, like, I deal with in L.A. Blues, I deal with women in prison, the
right.
effect it has on their children when they come out in 20 years later,
right.
reunions that come from that, but also foster care. We have a real large population of second and third generation of African-American children who were raised in foster care,
yep.
who are grown
now. Me too, I did
some
time in it. Yep. I did some time in foster care, too. I was in foster care for a while.
Okay. Yep. So these are the stories that I'd like to see. I said, you know, it'd be easy for me. I've written my stories somewhere and
mm-hmm.
got my little demons out. But I had two parents. I looked back and I was doing good. A lot of people don't have it. You know, we were poor and didn't have this and that. But basically, I had the, back then, more people had two parents. And
mm-hmm.
so, and nobody went to prison and drugs weren't a big problem in the community, just alcoholism at that point.
Right.
And,
right.
But I'm finding now that I'm writing about my character Z, who's been raised in the system, whose brother's a Crip, mother's a Crip, it's making me have to walk in somebody else's shoes, and it's making
mm-hmm.
me realize
I love
a
that.
Lot of people's reality that's not
right
in mine. But and it's making me see that I can't sit and judge. Well, they shouldn't be doing that. They should be.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't be writing that hip hop. They shouldn't be writing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When that's what they've experienced, Dr. Dre and
mm-hmm.
Snoop and all them, they came from Long Beach and around this area. That, you know, I moved here at 30, so I'm not from L.A., but as I've
right.
done research, I'm seeing that it shaped a lot of the West Coast rap, what they experienced as young people growing up, and that's what...
I think that's some of the best writing. Like, when you just said, don't judge. One of the things that I did when I was first starting, I stopped doing it a little bit when I had you as an editor, because I think we talked about that too. But when you're judging your characters, you're holding them back. Like, I've never abused my child. I wasn't a whore. You know, I wasn't an alcoholic where I had to drink every day. I didn't do any of these things, but I was able to deliver that in this character, you know, in my book. But when I first started writing, I was holding her back, and I talked to my business partner. She's like, why you let her be who she is? And that was so freeing, because when I did that, it just came across exactly how I wanted it to.
Right.
And I remember outrageous that situation.
And over the top.
Oh,
you make
she
your
was
character
who she
do
was.
What they want to do.
Yep.
Because when you're trying to protect them, it's because you're identifying with them.
Exactly.
I don't want her to get hurt, and I don't want her to get kidnapped, and I don't want her to get raped.
I wouldn't say that, or I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't, you know, no. Just you take yourself out of that and let your characters do what your characters do. And that's hard. If you don't recognize it. I think when you do recognize it, that's how your books are different. Like, my main characters are different in each one of my books. They're not the same characters, because I'm conscious of that now.
Right.
Because if I'm doing them based on me, they're going to be the same. If I'm doing them based on the situation and what they're going through, they'll be different each time.
Right. And the whole thing is that you want to build a character that is almost heroic, even when they're, or larger than life, even when
right.
they're flawed, very heavily flawed, they should still be larger than life in a way that readers say this person is out of the ordinary, and that they're interested
right.
to follow them. They're almost like leaders, even though they're strong and you know, might not be the nicest person.
Right.
Something about them, you see courage, you see leadership, you see some strengths too, as well as the weaknesses. And I think that's what readers identify with more. They don't want to see little ordinary people in a
book. No, they don't. They can look around. I try to write. I want you to think about my character before you think about my storyline when you close my book. I want you to say, I know Majesty was going to do that. Like, she always tug at her cap. Or, you know, she's always, you know, eating this. Or she, watch. I want you to feel like you know her or know my characters when I write my books. I write books now that are character-driven, not plot-driven. When I first started, it was plot-driven. And now I'm realizing, you know, that's not it. I need to write characters that, like, jump off the page that are just different from, like you said, anything or anybody that you know. And that's what I do now in my books.
That's a good piece of advice for writers, too. Because if you think about it, all the famous books, it's the characters everybody remembers. Scarlet,
right.
Just even Uncle Tom. You think of the, and then from Color Purple, Celie, and
right.
Character, we and Suge, and what Sophia, when they beat
right.
the police up.
mm-hmm.
Don't nobody just, it's, so it's the characters that will endure. It's not, oh, I remember this happened, that happened.
Yeah, that happened, that scene, no. That, you may get a few shock points when they close that book and go to the next one, they will not remember your story.
All right.
Yeah, and that's why I like strong characters.
And you can get more series out of characters. When people identify with the characters, they want to see what they're going to do in the next book.
Exactly. That's another thing that I definitely remember. And yeah, I know you don't remember, but I remember, like, when I was on The Face That Launched 1,000 Bullets, you told me to give him something that he did, whether it be chess or playing the game or something that makes that's going to bring life to that character. And I really expanded upon that now. I make sure that I put them almost in situations where they have to do certain things, and you feel like you know this person because the characters are so strong. So that's another thing that I do right now. I make sure that my characters pop, not just my plots. I have good plots, but plots, you know, like how many car chase scenes and robberies can you have? After a while, they're all the same. It's
right.
The characters.
Well, we're at the end of the show. I thank you so much, T-Style. Give out your website real quick.
It's the Cartel Public. It's www.thecartelpublications.com. And I'm also on Facebook at Author T-Style. But I don't think I can accept any more people because I'm over my limit.
Okay, well, I'm about to have a fan page for the Cartel Publications.
Yep, Author T-Styles is my fan page, and Cartel Publications, we have a fan page also.
All right.
And on Twitter. Author T-Styles on Twitter.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks again. Continued success. I'm really proud of you, and I'll have
Thank
you back.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Take care.
You
please,
too.
All right. Please return next week. See you and love you all. Bye-bye.